Hey everybody, I'm Mirban Aranchad and we're here at Tennis Summit 2018 to talk about on and off court ways to play healthy tennis in adult and junior players with Dr. Neeru Jayanthi. Dr. Jayanthi leads Emory's tennis medicine program and is considered one of the country's top experts on youth sports health, injuries, and sports training patterns, as well as being an international leader in tennis medicine. Neeru is also currently the president of the International Society for Tennis Medicine and Science, otherwise known as STMS, and he is a certified USPTA teaching professional. Neeru has also been a volunteer ATP physician for 15 years. He serves as a medical advisor for the WTA Player Development Panel, and Neeru is also on the commission for the International Tennis Performance Association, of which I'm a proud member as well. Neeru, it's really a pleasure to have you on the summit today, and I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you. Happy to be here, and good thing you set up to get, I'm really big on education in the tennis world, and it seems like this really reaches quite a few people, so I'm happy to try to get some of this education out there.
Yeah, Neeru, again, I really do appreciate it, and obviously a ton of players, including myself, sometimes struggle with staying healthy. And, you know, obviously if we have physical issues, then there's no way for us to reach our tennis potential. So I'm really excited to have such a fantastic and amazing expert like you, Neeru, to help us with this stuff. So I guess I'll let you kick it off.
Absolutely. Sure. So, you know, I'm, you know, very big into the tennis education world. And, you know, I want to dedicate this particular talk to a close friend of mine who, unfortunately, recently passed away from leukemia after a long battle, but Oliver Stevens was actually a master PTR professional, gave talks for us at STMS, was ITPA certified and just an amazing coach and human, and unfortunately he could not overcome a battle with leukemia, but I know that he would you know, want us to continue. I debated about whether I should do this or not, and I thought, you know what, he's always been a fighter, and so this is really for him. So I really want to direct this talk towards, you know, many players and coaches, and maybe some medical people are out there, but try to get people to, you know, look at a little bit of a approach to just on and off court method to stay healthy through tennis. And, you know, I originally actually came from Chicago, and this is some of our winters and gave me a lot of time to work on some of these projects indoors. But after almost 40 years, you know, in the cold, you know, Midwest, I finally occurred to me to make sure I move my tennis medicine program to a nice warm place like Atlanta where tennis is year round at Emory. And it's been great. There's really great opportunities to play tennis and actually help other people, adults and juniors in the tennis world when they potentially do get hurt. I have a couple of kids are grown up now, but my son's shirt says, "I'm told I like tennis there." And it's maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but you know, our whole family, we've been around, we're around the tennis community quite a bit. So it's not just a side passion. This is actually my entire life. There's our first one there when I was covering an ATP tournament. And then he's got a doubles partner now, Millen. These are both my kids, and my older is on his, I think he's on his either third or fourth racket. So they are able to get out there, but at their own pace. So I never force them to do anything. This is more of a family fun environment. So, you know, tennis, I'm a sports medicine physician, a non-surgical sports medicine physician. We call it primary care sports medicine. So we look at the whole person. You know, I help create, I think it may be the first medically based tennis medicine program at a University Medical Center. It was in Chicago at Loyola, and then now at Emory here in Atlanta. And really, as you might see on the screen, it's really the comprehensive approach to all medical and musculoskeletal issues for the adult and the junior player and elite players. And the goal is really to keep them participating. And it's not just, hey, let me just take care of your tennis elbow and see you later. But this is a longitudinal approach to make sure we, you know, the recurrence rates are high. And so we want to keep you healthy and keep hitting. This involves a lot of people. And for those of you who do take care of tennis players at all levels, this involves, you know, there's a medical aspect, which is only one aspect of it. And that includes, but then it includes many other things, which is something I do. I actually do on-court evaluations, go on court with a lot of, about 89% of them are junior elite players. and college players, but sometimes I'll bring some adults on that are very passionate and evaluate their strokes, you know, for potential risks or after they're coming back from an injury. We work in with many tennis clubs and teaching professionals who often have easy access to talk to me about certain players that they might need me to take a look at. There's therapists and other health professionals like strength and conditioning and performance trainers who have a tennis background knowledge, for example, in ITPA or STMS. And we do a lot of, you know, event coverage and education and research. And the reason I say this is because I think finding a healthcare professional who has an understanding of tennis and maybe even certifications through STMS or ITPA helps you realize that they are getting the cutting edge information. That's what we're really kind of trying to ask people to do, is just find the healthcare professionals you think that can suit you the best. And when you do see someone, you should hopefully get a real comprehensive approach. I think you got to treat tennis players differently than you treat any other person who comes in and says, my shoulder hurts, because there's so many other elements. And so that includes getting a little bit of a tennis specific history, knowing which exam maneuvers you would do. Maybe you go on court with them. I think I'm a little unusual in that way, but even without that understanding and communicating with the tennis pro, keep doing things like this, educating your community about tennis education. And maybe we do a lot of research, but you know, maybe you actually find data to help support some of the things you do. Preventing injury and looking at performance are actually also very key things. And so I keep saying comprehensive care could include nutrition, psychology. And so get connected with those people who understand tennis and have a good understanding of the tennis player. And these are the organizations I mentioned, which is STMS and ITPA, which are some of them that can really help understanding of medical and performance aspects of tennis. For STMS, we run a journal, and it's really meant to help put things on paper and try to get, it's really originally all for the organizations like ATP, WTA, and ITF. But in fact, now we're producing information for the average player and junior players as well. So we want everyone to have access to the best data that's available. For this particular talk, and we'll also have some component where I'll take some more general questions, but I really want to look at the adult and junior player and talk about the tennis-specific treatments and also those things on court that you should look out for. We'll have some videos as well, too, to kind of take a look. Before I start, I spent a lot of time treating injuries in tennis, and you got to remember, I'm a tennis advocate, and, play tennis. It is the healthiest sport out of all sports. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a little biased and inclined towards tennis. If you look at published data, this is from British Journal of Sports Medicine, the number one sports medicine impact journal in the world, over 80,000 adults, the risk reduction of death over a 9-year period was almost 50% in racket sports and primarily tennis. Nothing was even close. Swimming was 28% as far as risk reduction. And this is adjusting for all other factors. So it is truthfully the best sport. So if you can get through juniors, get through college, and actually continue playing as an adult, your likelihood of impacting your overall health is significantly higher. So that, if there's no other reason to keep the kids healthy and college players healthy, it's this. Before you treat any, we'll talk a little bit about junior and adult. Before you treat anyone, you really have to understand what a tennis player goes through. And we looked at a lot of data. We had over 500 kids in the Midwest. These were sexually ranked kids from a number of years ago. And if you look at training profiles, this is pretty consistent for junior players. The median is about 16 to 20 hours a week, particularly in the high peaks of the year, off in the summer, for training. About 11 to 25 tournaments a year is roughly where the median is. And about 70% specialize in tennis only. Now, that number goes significantly higher once you get beyond 14, 15, 16 years old, where, essentially 90, 95% of them specialize only in tennis. And they do that at a pretty young age, at about 10. And we'll talk a little bit about that later as well, too. But there may be some additional risk with specializing in only tennis at a very young age, as far as injury and burnout. What about adults and tour players? Well, where do they get hurt? Well, tour players, this is an old study, but still pretty consistent, is the back actually is the number one reason to pull out of ATP tournaments. And then the foot and the ankle and hip and thigh, really lower extremity injuries are where a lot of the better players get it. If you look at, we did a study looking at over 500 adult tennis players, and you know, it's really upper extremity injuries like elbow and shoulder, and then followed by some knee and back. So, but elbow and shoulder are really, really common. And I'm sure many of you listening are probably thinking, yep, I have all of these. And mm-hmm. and so we know that that's probably age dependent and technique dependent as well too. Some you can control, some you can't. We published, it's actually publicly available, an article called Tendinopathy in Tennis. And the reason I say this is because a lot of people say, well, I have a tendinitis in my shoulder and I have a tendinitis in my elbow. And you actually have to get a better understanding of what that really means. And tendinitis is actually very rare, especially in the adult. Most of these are what we call a tendinopathy, where the tendon itself gets a little more abnormal and then worn and torn and maybe even degenerative. And you have to treat it and you have to respect it that way. And you're wondering why some of these things take so long to get better. There's probably a tendinopathy component. And you know, this is public available. If you just search it, I think you should be able to find it. It kind of goes through those stages, but hopefully it'll help explain some of the frustration with some of the tendon problems you've had, whether it's the elbow tendon, the rotator cuff, or Achilles tendon. And again, I think getting healthcare providers who really understand those differences is critical, because you know, some tendon problems can last months and even years and need more dedicated specific treatments. If we go back to our study that we looked at, it was over 500 adult tennis players recreational. We kind of wanted to look at injury patterns. And this is, I think, a lot of the folks that may be on, you know, on involved in this tennis summit here is, you know, we noticed that injury patterns are very high. If you look at 100 adult league players, over 50 of them would have, so the prevalence rate is over 50%, really. So more people are likely to have some injury that kept them out for at least a week or longer. In fact, if you talk to most of your teammates and your teams, I bet you it's going to be hard to find anyone who didn't have some injury who kept them out for at least a week throughout the whole year. But what's even interesting is the majority of these are overuse. And as you get older from your NTRP level from 2.5 all the way to, I'm sorry, as you get better from 2.5 to up to 5.0, you'll find that the injury risk is actually gets to be higher and higher. But you start getting more traumatic injuries like we talked about, because the pace of the game is much higher. So I don't worry about those as much in the less skilled player, but it's those overuse injuries. The other thing is you also look at volume and how much you play. So if you combine your age, your level, and then how much you might be playing, then you can decide how much risk there is. And the red, you know, points out to the overuse, and the blue is the increase in traumatic injuries as your NTRP level gets higher. And so it's fascinating how much people use, how much equipment do you use. You go on court and you see someone who wearing a tennis elbow brace, a knee brace, a sleeve here. We actually asked our 538 respondents, you know, how much of those things they use. And, you know, it's really, the rate is uncommon when you don't have any injury, but those that have had one or even two or more injuries, they average, you know, at least one or sometimes even two pieces of injury modifying equipment for every player. So people are strapping on all sorts of stuff, probably with little evidence to support that it actually is making a difference. Tennis elbow straps can help reduce symptoms, and there's certain compression sleeves that are showing some improvement. Kinesio tape and other things like that are self-applied, I'm not sure are going to make big differences. I know there's big businesses behind that, but people wearing those bright colors all over and putting on themselves, it takes a lot of actually training to be able to put on Kinesio tape appropriately, even for experienced WTA and ATP Tour physical therapists. Okay, so let's say you go in and now you're going to get evaluated by a tennis health professional who understands tennis a bit. You really should, be able to get this type of information out there. We got to figure out what your goals are for tennis, and if you're a recreational player. But I'm in Atlanta. I mean, the recreational player is almost as competitive as the Georgia Tech tennis athletes that I take care of. Where, you know, they're on two or three teams and they're playing, you know, six times a week. And so, look at the goals of each athlete. And the junior players, knowing if they're a nationally ranked kid versus a locally ranked kid changes their risk quite a bit. So if you are that high-level nationally ranked kid, most of those will be training at very high volumes. Obviously, it puts them a little bit of a risk. And so when you get beyond 16 hours a week, or more hours per week than your age, your risk increases quite a bit. 16 is a magic number that people get much more likely to increase their risk at that age. And then that the tolerance for an adult is much less. You'll see that getting beyond 6 hours a week is probably when that injury risk increases. And so I think most adults can probably tolerate up to six, but 6 to 10 is where it increases, then 10 or more for sure. But just be cautious, especially if you're coming off an injury, that would essentially limit to about 2 or 3 times a week. Now I want everyone to play every day all week long, but some bodies just aren't tolerant to that, especially at higher levels. And then look at how much competition. Competition risks are always higher than training. So if I'm getting someone back in a controlled environment with just hitting, I'm more likely to say, why don't you just go back and hit rather than trying to get back into match as the first thing. So match play is definitely more risky because obviously things change and your intensity changes for adult and junior players. When you've already had an injury, that's the biggest single risk in any sport and every study basically of having another injury. So if you've hurt your back already before in the past, you've been out for a while, the likelihood you're going to have a back problem again is much higher. And in our data, that was about 5 times the risk. And that's pretty common throughout at every level too, no matter if you're adult, junior, professional. And so you got to address those things fully, rehab them fully, and then know how to recognize them early. I've had a number of injuries myself that put me out for an entire season, and nothing drives me more nuts than losing 3 or 6 months of a tennis year because of an injury that I'd already had. So I actually, about 15 years ago, I dedicated myself to making sure that I wasn't going to progress and miss lots of time. I don't mind missing a week or 2 weeks, recognizing things early. Another thing is specializing in tennis, in cross training, other sports. And I actually speak all across the world on this because our data in all athletes supports that the risk of injury is definitely higher if you specialize in a single sport, particularly at a young age. We recognize tennis is one of those sports where people do it early and often, but you have to know that it is going to increase your risk. And you can still be successful, and doesn't mean you can't be successful, just that your risk increases a bit. And even for adults, finding other ways to kind of modify your training, maybe get maybe start swimming. I actually did that as well too. My body is kind of getting to the point where it's hard to get through a long 3-set match and then go back and play another one the next day. So I get in the pool, ride your bike and offload your upper body as well to your shoulder and elbow with other activities. It may reduce some of your injury risk. And the junior players particularly need to spend more time off court. They're training 16, 20 hours a week, but maybe not all of it needs to be on court. They should do some conditioning and injury prevention as well.
Sorry for interrupting, Nero. I was just curious about the cross-training aspect. Yeah. I was wondering about the reason for why that helps players with their health. Is it more that is it because it's decreasing the amount of time they're spending playing tennis, or is it because it strengthens their body more, or what's the reasoning behind that?
Both of those actually. And so, you're only going to take so much load to a certain body area for so much, especially as you get older, right? So let's say you have a we'll call it a back problem or a shoulder rotator cuff issue. So doing the same thing over and over again, that area is, at some point the tissue is probably degenerative and it's only going to tolerate so much. So unloading it, doing other things is helpful. And then hopefully you're providing strengthen other muscle areas as well too, and flexibility. Trying to do different things, and that really we think helps the junior player develop them into better athletes. But I think the adult player then just gets more longevity. I mean, I think we're all in it to try to keep playing as long as you can. Throughout life, like into your hopefully 70s, and it takes some work to do that.
Great, thanks.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
sure. Totally. And feel free to jump in for any of the questions like that. So, then again, as far as stroke history, whether it's adult or junior, I mean, we change our strokes. And when we change our strokes, we're changing, our risk of developing a problem. One of the biggest types of changes is actually having the aggressive topspin stroke, which obviously helps. But you have to be very cautious. Now, when a junior player is developing that, I'm okay with it because that's part of developing an elite level game. But when you take a 2.5 or 3.0, relatively new player, and start giving them aggressive topspin, their tolerance is much less. So just be cautious of that. And when I evaluate them, I also want to know what type of stroke and what part of the stroke bothers them. And when we do stroke mechanics, we'll talk about why those are important so we can make some changes. Equipment changes help, you know, help us as well too, and new rackets and changing your string tension. And we generally say choose the heaviest racket that doesn't change your swing speed when you're choosing. And I'm not going to pretend, I'm sure you have many equipment experts that are on, but from my perspective, it's how it changes what you're doing on court. So if you have a very light racket and you swing excessively heavy, that's when you may run into injury. And then also with string tension, you want to typically want to say lower the string tension, you know, just to limit how much extra force you have to apply to taking, you know, hitting a ball. And so that's the first, one of the first simple steps you do, you know, especially in the light of an injury. All right. So now you have a junior player and you're trying to figure out, well, which junior players have the most types of risk? And if we look through the data and I summarize the data here, you'll see that the risk increases in a number of ways. Some of them are volume dependent. For example, once you play beyond the fourth match of a tournament, your risk of pulling out of that tournament is about two or three times higher. And we looked at that with junior national tournaments, you know, and found a pretty consistent finding there. Playing more than 40 singles matches a year, playing more than 15 tournaments a year, and we talked about the 16 hours a week, and in fact, specifically more hours per week than your age. So if you're only 10 or 12 years old, you would actually try to stay under 10 or 12 hours per week. And then after three consecutive weeks of tournaments, the WTA found a significant increase in medical withdrawals. So they really try to have their players not play beyond three consecutive weeks. We talk about match play versus practice and playing with prior injury and a number of these other things. And so you kind of create a profile as whether you're at risk or not. And if you have a national ranking, you're a junior player, you're most likely a high-risk athlete. That's just the way that the system is set up. So we have to pay attention to symptoms in certain areas. And so, you know, some of the areas are, you know, we tend to see a lot of lower extremity injuries in young and more advanced players because of the high intensity that's going on. We do see some upper extremity injuries in the shoulder and the elbow. We try to work on these deficits, but sometimes we're successful. But the biggest thing for me is actually the low back in a young athlete. And low back, if you're a young junior tennis player with a high ranking, the likelihood that you would have a back stress injury or stress fracture is about 40%. And it's an exceedingly high number for a condition that could put you out for 3 months or longer. So you want to recognize that immediately rather than waiting until it's too late. So if you're an adult athlete and you may be high risk, if your age is more than 40 years old, that means you have about a 50% chance you'll develop tennis elbow. We talked about playing more than 6 hours a week. And as you get more advanced, which is good, your risk actually increases from an injury point of view. And we talked again about making technique changes, especially when they're abrupt and perhaps in the wrong setting as well too, depending on who's showing you what you need to do. And those who have been injured over 40, it seems like everyone's already had an injury, but just know that keeps looming around there. So rehab completely from any injury to improve your chances. So what's the areas you should be concerned about? And it kind of differs for each one, but you know, the adult player, we worry about low back as well too, but they get disc problems. Everything they get is like the opposite in the low back from an extension-based stress fracture potentially that a junior player would get. Adult players get tennis elbow, which is on the outside of the elbow, and junior players get inside the elbow problems, which is much higher risk. Remember, the junior players do not get tennis elbow, and they get things like the growth plate, perhaps the ligament, in other areas, even the nerve. Shoulder stuff, an adult such as my shoulder would have rotator cuff problems and rotator cuff wear and tear, while a junior player would not actually have any abnormalities, but they actually just get kind of an impingement where it gets irritated, and it's usually much easier to treat. Now, if you're really young, you can get growth plate problems, and we certainly see those as well. And then we'll talk about wrist injuries and emerging hip injuries that are happening more with a condition called hip impingement. So if you look at our Emory Tennis Medicine website, we try to create a risk profile so you as a player can decide when is it time to stop, keep playing, or maybe even see someone. So if you're a high risk junior, for example, we run through all those risks that we just talked about. You are at significantly increased risk for bad stress fractures, growth plate injuries, and other conditions that we worry about. And I usually ask people, those kids, to stop playing right away and probably get seen right away. And I have my cell phone, email, and everything available so I can get them in immediately, because I am concerned about getting a late stage injury that puts them out for long periods. You're low risk. You're a kid that only plays a couple months a year, plays a lot of other sports, and only plays a few hours a week. I'm not that worried, and it's very unusual to get high risk injuries in those kids. And we may just say, you know, keep playing or just try to modify a little bit, and then we can see them on a more routine basis. So it really varies based on the kid. Same thing when we look at an adult. If you have a lot of, you know, injuries in the past, you're out for extended periods, you're a high volume player, you're a little bit more advanced, then, you know, we recommend maybe you should be seen earlier. And even if you have 2 days of symptoms in the elbow, you might have had years of degeneration in that tendon, and so you could be out for long periods even with only a short time frame of actual symptoms. And again, there's the lower risk player, the low level player only plays a couple hours a week. Generally, you know, we're not as concerned, but again, as an adult, you may have more degenerative conditions, and it just takes more work to get them better. And I don't think this is new news to many of you listening out there, that you know, as you get older, it gets harder. So it just takes more work to rehab a tendon. We call it eccentric strengthening, and to maintain as well too after an injury. We'll show you a couple of practical ways as well to do that. We published a manuscript in our Tennis Medicine Journal through STMS about ideal tournament training recommendations. And, you know, in that, we're trying to look at what we can suggest for these young junior players with regard to training volume, looking at strokes, and then looking at whether screening you know, kids is effective. And this is a program we're doing with USDA Southern and trying to get assessments on young kids and tournament players before they get a problem and address it early, either it's a stroke or musculoskeletal risk. You know, ask yourself, and your pro should ask yourself, you know, ask you how you're feeling. If you don't look good when you're hitting, you know, what's wrong? I go to matches and I watch a lot of, you know, different types of players play. And I can tell, you know, I help with our Georgia Tech, you know, tennis teams, which are phenomenal players, but you can tell the difference when someone's not moving the same, they're not hitting the serve, they're taking something off, you know, their ground strokes. So you ask how they're feeling, or if they have the same pain that's continuing. Sometimes you know, they can't even shake your hand because their elbow hurts so much. And these are simple clues you know, this is not normal. And, you know, there's a point of, they ask, like, when is it appropriate? When is it pain or just the soreness? Well, if it's impacting your performance, there may be a problem. If you can't get up the next day and start playing again, then that's an issue, you know, if it's lingering beyond just like, I felt a little sore because I played that day. And you got to know which areas are the areas you got to pay attention to. And so, you know, I put out the low back, elbow, and shoulder, the ones that may actually put you out for long periods of time. And I have a kind of a simple rule. I've never studied it in research, even though I do a lot of research, but I like this rule. So if you have pain in a high-risk area for a day, stop that day. Try it again another day. Just say, you know what, it's not working today, especially in the high-risk junior player. If you have pain for a week, even if it's kind of a low-level pain, just stop for about a week, and then you might consider getting seen. And if it's still going on in about 2 weeks, 2 weeks is about the time where you can start developing actual real problems. For example, you can start developing stress fractures in the back that could last for a while. So that's when we say, hey, time to go in, get taken a look at, because you know, when we get it late, it's a lot harder to treat. Just, it takes a lot longer usually. Understand that each tennis player is different, and our bodies are made differently. And because of tennis, we have what we call asymmetric adaption. So one side, your dominant side, for example, your right-handed, your right side, will have differences in the way your shoulder, elbow, forearm, even back and abdominal muscles are formed. The shoulder is the most common example of that. And so some of you might look in the mirror and say, what's going on? I have this shoulder droop in my, you know, in the back of my, you know, from one shoulder to the other. This is actually a left-handed tennis player. You can see there's a shoulder droop on the left. And you can see what's called a scapular slide. The scapula starts, shoulder blade starts to slide over a bit. And those are normal adaptions, but you got to work around that. So you got to do things to strengthen that shoulder blade and scapula to try to help maintain some of that control. And if this this pattern continues, we think that may create additional shoulder-related problems. Another thing that happens, as you can see here, is that their rotation goes back more because of how much when you're serving and hitting overhead strokes, you get more rotation called external rotation. But you get less internal rotation. You can see on this screen here, this is the external rotation, and here's the internal rotation, which is actually somewhat limited. And so when you get that pattern, we think you want to improve your internal rotation. One of the ways to do it is what we call a posterior capsular stretch or a sleeper stretch. You just lay on your side and then actually just push your arm down in internal rotation as this player is doing here. And that can help actually some athletes improve their internal rotation, especially the better players who are trying to maintain their shoulder. These changes happen very early. Happen as early as 8 to 11 years old. And then if you play a lot of tennis, you know, it's certainly something that can continue to develop even on young tennis players. So it's never too early to start working on those things. Let's go to junior tennis players. And then I want to spend a few minutes actually on some stroke analysis. And then we'll have you ask some questions here. The areas we talked about, low back, elbow, and shoulder, and also the wrist is an emerging one. We're going to do a lot with stroke analysis looking at that. And so when we get to return to play, we want to look at what are the reasons. So we looked at volume, prior injury, and all these other factors, but what about things you're doing on court? What are the things that are actually making you more likely to have this problem? And when you do get an injury and when you go back, how are you returning back? Are you doing the same thing, or are you making some progressions, going a slow, progressive way? So this is what I call your risk spectrum. If you have good strokes, you can tolerate high volume probably, and your risk isn't going to be as high. But if you have poor strokes mechanics and you have high volume, then you're going to be at increased risk for injury. If you're on the other end of the spectrum, you have good strokes and low volume, then you really have low risk, right, of injury. And so you kind of look at which category you are. So that last category of poor stroke mechanics and high volume of play is the riskiest area. And so we published a series looking at a number of junior elite tennis players. After I had seen them in the office, I brought them on court following an injury and try to get them back to see if we can make some modifications on certain conditions and what would their success be in returning to play. And we were able to get over 90% of them back, continuing to play at 6 months too. It's not just getting them back, but staying there by some of these changes. And so these changes were really, in areas, the most common reason I took those kids out was actually low back injuries, such as stress fractures in the back, then shoulder, then the ulnar wrist, which we'll go over, and then the medial elbow, which is the inside of the elbow. And like I said, about 94% were able to return at 6 months. And, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot is actually this low back issue. And you can see this player here with an enormous amount of extension where they're leaning back quite a bit on their low back. And, you know, Mark Kovacs, who's a close colleague and friend of mine, looked at when might be an appropriate age. And I thought could be to delay kick serves until at least age 13. We may be adding that too early for kids, making them arch their back a little bit too early. And, here's a neutral spine, low back, and someone who actually did deal with this type of injury and now has modified her game. We created what's called a stroke efficiency rating system, myself with a number of other researchers and collaborate with Mark Kovacs, and want to assess the risk for future injury and also correct those in a development way so we could pick out certain areas of the strokes. And it's pretty complicated. I'm not going to go over the entire thing. We're just going to go over key parts of certain injury risk areas on either the preparation, acceleration, or deceleration phases. And we have a lot of data on this, and I don't want to get too research heavy, so we're just going to go over the actual concepts. One of them is low back extension, like we just talked about on the left, who has enormous, trying to hit a kick serve, has enormous amount of low back extension. And then here is her getting more neutral spine to avoid some of that. And I think some of the tennis coaches call that the trophy position. We call that the loading position. And so let's see if this video will come through here, and we can see the difference between the two.
In a serve so that it would reduce your overall risk of stress injuries. As you can see during the loading phase on this serve, during preparation, you can see more knee bend with almost no lumbar extension. and then some transverse planar rotation that will reduce the overall risk of load to the posterior elements of the serve.
And so, I don't. Do you think I need to play that again, or is that adequate?
Should no, that looked great. That was perfect.
Okay. And so we have, you know, so I have concerns. So that's a simple change, and it's more complicated change. But if you just think about a simple change for a low back, for a junior player, and even kind of elite level college player, you can reduce hopefully some of the risks for stress fractures. And again, here's what it looks like hitting a neutral spine serve on someone who actually had to deal with that, you know, a junior player that we looked at, and then has a, you know, nice follow through finishing up from right to left. Big thing, you know, is getting this rear and front knee flexion. So when you get a little bit more flexion in your rear knee versus your front knee, and this is actually a pretty significant amount of knee flexion for her. She's a shorter player with a great explosion. You actually can improve lower body forces to prevent upper body forces from taking on more. And so we always say bend your knee, but specifically get that rear knee, the back knee, down a little bit more than the front knee. Courtesy of Mark Kovacs, he put together these slides, which look really, you know, telling of a player. We all know, you know, Andy Roddick, who when he was younger, you can see this amazing amount of what we call a shoulder lag, where his arm and his elbow do not get up to even 90 degrees at all. There's so many other things going down wrong with his lower body, but if you just look at the upper body, again, pretty significant shoulder lag right here again. And then he finally corrects this, you know, and had pretty good serve. This is at 90 degrees. His arm and lower body are in conjunction, and they're elevated appropriately. Another area we look at with the shoulders, again, from Mark Kovacs, he has a couple of these nice pictures of hyperangulation, is lining up the front arm with the right, your dominant shoulder and elbow, so that it doesn't pull back too far. And then when you do pull back too far, you get that risk of what we call hyperangulation for shoulder issues and potentially elbow issues as well. So we really want to line that up nicely on all players. This is not just for a junior or adult alone. A thing that we may see sometimes is what we call short arm axis. So valgus is when you get this extra force to the inside part of your elbow. And so you see this player here, when they make contact, they're not fully extended with their arm, and they kind of have a little bit of elbow flexion in there, which creates more force to the elbow. And so this player has a more linear motion in there, and they make contact with their arm in an extended position. And so we watch for that as well, too, to make sure there's no excess elbow valgus. And that happens more likely on spin serves, like a slice. Or a better player may have problems in the inside of the elbow. We say adult players who have tennis elbow typically are more recreational, and then the better players get inside the elbow problems, and particularly in junior and elite players. And this is with that extreme forehand grip with the full Western sometimes and heavy topspin may cause it. When we look at the wrist, we see also in an attempt to get a lot of excess rotation and spin, you may see what we call ulnar deviation, where this racket is almost pointed down at about 45 degrees, rather than having it be about 20 degrees and more level. So what kind of things can you do to modify that? We'll show you a video on that as well too here, okay? So this is getting too much ulnar deviation.
Ulnar wrist pain can happen in the dominant wrist on a forehand stroke. As you can see here in a forehand stroke in a junior player, as this player is loading, there is quite a bit of ulnar deviation on this stroke, which poses risk to the ulnar carpal joint, including the TFCC and ECU tendons.
So this is actually a junior player, high school kid, who we were able to correct pretty quickly. And just shooting the video, we said, you know, we just hit a forehand. Now let's change that forehand and try to see if we can reduce how much ulnar deviation.
A few ways to reduce the amount of ulnar deviation on the forehand stroke may be to lower the body more in the forward lunge position, and that will allow more leveling and straightening and reduced ulnar deviation when making contact, and then follow through without as much wrist rotation. This may reduce the risk to the ulnar carpal joint.
You can see how level she is at the time of contact there. So, and just lowering that, getting a lunge position and not dropping that wrist. So very simple things. And ulnar wrist pain is really becoming more and more common because these kids are trying to whap the ball with lots of topspin. And similarly, on the backhand, it's a non-dominant wrist. And so for right-hand players, it's left wrist. See all the ulnar deviation on this particular stroke, and then the other one we see it more level. So I think we have a video on that as well too. And so how much is appropriate? We don't know, but we know this is probably too much. You know, this is probably about 50 degrees. So, you know, we think maybe up to 30 degrees is okay, but that's quite a bit of drop of that left wrist over there. And so let's see how this looks on the backhand.
Ulnar wrist pain can also occur on the backhand stroke on the non-dominant wrist. Similarly, when there is quite a bit of ulnar deviation prior to and at the point of contact, this may cause problems to the ulnar carpal joint, including the TFCC and ECU tendons.
And so let's see if we can improve that with a simple change.
Risk to the ulnar carpal joint related to excess ulnar deviation can be corrected through a few mechanisms on the backhand stroke on the non-dominant wrist. This would include lowering the body in a forward lunge position again, and prior to point of contact, keeping the wrist above the hands and keeping it level, and with limited ulnar deviation on the non-dominant wrist through the backhand stroke, as you can see in this frame. This will reduce the overall risk to the ulnar carpal joint after many, many strokes.
There's a number of other things you could do, but it's the simplest thing to do, and it's cueing and actually just telling a player like this who didn't realize how much he was doing was actually quite simple. You can see him side by side here.
Risk to the ulnar carpal joint related to excess ulnar deviation can be corrected through a few mechanisms on the backhand stroke on a non-dominant wrist. This would include lowering the body in a forward lunge position again, and prior to point of contact, keeping the wrist above the hands and keeping it level, and with limited ulnar deviation on a non-dominant wrist through the backhand stroke, as you can see in this frame. This will reduce the overall risk to the ulnar carpal joint after many, many strokes.
And it actually made her stroke better. And there's a lot of correlation between your performance and what you do and how you reduce your injury as well too. Sometimes you're more at risk. But let's look at the elbow in the adult player then. You know, this is a very common scenario. You take a 42-year-old who you know, has a lateral elbow pain or in the outside of the elbow. And, you know, we see all sorts of problems there. And you know, we think maybe it's because of one hand backhand, but I'll tell you what, there's a nice study and just me seeing this in clinic all the time is, you know, the forehand and serve with excess forearm pronation, which we'll show, is as big of a culprit. So it's not just hitting one hand backhand. This is all strokes. Any of these strokes can cause it, especially if you're 40 and older. And actually, I should change that number to 30 and older. There's a 50% incidence if you're 30 or older. And it was, you know, easily the most common condition when we looked at over 500 adult recreational players in USTA leagues. You know, and so in the French Open, though, when they had a study of over 700 players, there was only, in the senior division, there was only one case of tennis elbow in 3 years. And this is adults who had already played on the tour, who are still playing, and they just don't get tennis elbow. Well, why is that? Well, we think tennis elbow should be called don't know how to play tennis elbow because you're doing things that are changing. This is definitely a technique issue in combination with age. I think technique is a huge component. So, you know, we know that, yes, volume more than 6 hours a week is a risk as you get older. But, you know, what can you do? And so we think, you know, this is one of the best interventional studies. This is done, gosh, 1992. But avoiding a forearm pronation, just getting tennis instruction in addition to usual treatment, helped improve almost 60 recreational adult players. And you can see how only 12 of them had pain on the backhand. Most of them were on the forehand and serve. So don't just think it's just a backhand problem. And so if you look at forearm pronation, this is hitting through the stroke here on the right. And that's when you rotate your arm around to hit your topspin. And for her, this player got good elbow extension, so she's not rotating early. But a lot of players don't even, their elbow's bent, and then they rotate around, and they end up getting quite a bit of force on the outside of the elbow. So you got to extend through the ball before you rotate. Okay, as simple as that. Okay, finally, we'll just go to the other common area called the low back. And low back in adult players, we were talking a lot about young players. You know, I get this a lot, including my own back. And we know that there's a nice German study that showed that doing 20-minute daily back exercise care program reduced pain ratings and also improve their performance and their actual strength improved in their back. And so it's something I give to a lot of adult players who have low back issues. And it's really, and I'm sure you can do a lot of different things, but a simple warm up and then doing rotational exercise and a lot of core stabilization, which is, you know, abdominal strengthening over there. And you can do plank exercises as well too. And these are a lot of stabilization exercises. And it doesn't have to be 20 minutes, but if you can get some component of spine stabilization with some simple mobility as well too, there's some pretty good evidence that you can maintain and actually improve your back symptoms. And so much better than taking medicines and doing injections and all these other things. So a back care program is big for me. And reducing what we call lumbar flexion, when you bend and rotate forward, as opposed to a junior player who has problems leaning back, adult players have stiffness if they're in the same position bending forward. So you want to reduce those even throughout the day, like at work and other areas. I get asked this question from my adult players is, can I have a hip replacement or a knee replacement and still go back to, you know, to tennis? So the answer is you're not supposed to, but you still probably can. So they can't tell you do a joint replacement and then, you know, and if you break your, you know, joint replacement, you could get mad at the surgeon. But in fact, a lot of players still went ahead and did it anyway and had pretty good results. Only a few revisions. The revision rate was only slightly higher if you went back to tennis. So now the general recommendations are that you probably can, you know, play doubles, and they say don't play singles, but I'm sure people are doing that as well too. After joint replacement, most of them are able to get back to doubles. So I always say, well, who listens to the doctor anyway? Just play as much as you can. And hopefully, you know, you have some access to the people who you need to if you do run into in trouble. So I'll leave it at that. Maybe if you have, you know, some questions here to finish up, we can try to help answer those.
Sure, Nehru. I really appreciate, I mean, the wonderful information and identifying and how we can kind of adjust to, you know, kind of either come back from injury or prevent injury. One question out of the few that many that I actually wrote down is, you know, when we're making, let's say, the ulnar deviation adjustment, does that mean that we're going to naturally kind of reduce our top spin on the ball, or is there some other way we can compensate for that and still produce top spin, or how does that work?
Yeah, so it's a bit, and I simplified it obviously, and I spend about an hour on court trying to make a modification. So there's a lot of different ways to generate force that don't involve unnecessary movements, such as early form pronation, for example, or dropping your wrist. So lower body lunge positions, and that's actually when you do it. So you want to get your racket to neutral or get it to be even on parallel to the ground at contact, but then getting through the ball, through the contact zone at the end of it, then getting your rotation and your forearm pronation, you can still get the toxin. You just don't want to start rotating so early that you never get through the ball. And so we watched Federer and all these, even Nadal, you think, boy, all he does is get revolutions around the ball. But if you actually watch him in slow motion, he's getting through the ball the entire way and then going around it so fast that you don't see how much the ball is actually on his strings going in a forward plane. So I think we miss that when we just watch it so rapidly on TV. So it's just that we don't emulate what you think is happening, but try to get through the ball first and get what we call these lower body lunge positions. It'll help your strokes. And I don't do this to make people like they actually come out and they're like, wow, I'm actually hitting a deeper ball. And actually I'm able to hit a more aggressive ball with less force without having to use your upper body as much.
Awesome stuff, Nehru. And I saw, obviously, you talked about how on the serve we should have more knee bend on the rear knee. And I do see a lot of amateurs putting a lot more weight on the front knee and not loading properly, as Mark Kovacs has talked about too. And so I was just curious as to the reasoning and or science behind why loading the back knee, at least for the right knee, when I say that for right-handers, why that helps prevent injuries.
So, I have to credit Mark Kovacs because he's the one who really introduced that concept to me. And we sat down, and when we created the stroke efficiency rating, we went through and we tried to identify all of the things that could be potential risks for injury. And then there was a number of things that were to improve performance. What we found was there's a significant overlap in those that prevent injury, but also improve performance. And so it's hard to really draw the line in some situations, and this is one of those. We know that lower body force generation clearly reduces the amount of load to your shoulder and elbow and then subsequently your wrist. So wherever it's coming from, so we know that most of it should come from there. And so one way to help with that is actually using, instead of, you know, sometimes I think it's not specific enough. They say, well, bend your knees. You know, we're trying to develop a more specific framework to say, well, you should get 30 to 45 degrees of knee bend on the right and at least 30 degrees on the left. Or, you know, we're trying to give you some markers to do that. So when a right-hand player gets this right rear knee and they elevate, then it forces them to get a good follow through. You go right to left. And so you land on your left. And so not only does it reduce your shoulder and elbow risk, it generates force forward going into the court. If you jump with your left and you then, let's say you load with your left knee up into the serve, then you finish on your right leg, you end up getting only half the body working. The right side of your body is swinging rather than using your entire body. And so you're right. I see so many adult players do that. They're just not comfortable standing on a single right leg and going to the left. So just, we have people work on their rhythm to do that over and over again, whether it's in a mirror or just taking a tennis ball, taking the racket and do a shadow swing. Some people it's hard to change when they've been doing it for 40 years or something like that. But you know, you'll be surprised what you're able to get some people to do. But yeah, that is a really important but simple concept.
Great stuff, Nira. And right around along the same sort of path, I was just curious because I've had friends who have had wrist issues on a two-hander, and I was wondering if you happen to know what type of adjustments, and maybe they're similar to what we talked about, but what type of adjustments Juan del Potro might have made on his backhand so that he could hit it again.
Well, I mean, he's been through the ringer with, you know, a number of surgeries, obviously, but I mean, finally, you got the point. You know, if you look at Ovidio, I mean, he had a significant ulnar deviation. Now he just basically flattens it out, and he basically doesn't have any ulnar deviation on his left hand of his backhand. And so another thing I do is I take a lot of, you know, it's more kind of junior and high level players. And I talk about hand dominance. And so if you are a right-handed player and you have a two-handed backhand, some may use their right hand about 50 to 75% of it, and then only 25%. So they're more right-hand dominant. While many people are these days are more left-handed dominant. It's almost like hitting a left-handed forehand. And so when most of the force is coming from the left hand, then the left wrist obviously gets it. So I ask people to reduce the amount of left hand or wrist dominance and try to get more towards 50-50. So the right hand does a little bit more of the work and then just reduce the ulnar deviation, lower the body more. And you'll see, I mean, Del Potro is completely flattened his out. And I mean, he's been through quite a bit of stuff, but I like to get kids before they have surgery. So try to have a lot of kids who had, you know, like early TFCC tears or ECU tendon problems, and they're just knocking on the door to having a long-term problem. And if I can just get them to modify that enough and become a little bit more right-hand dominant, if they're having a lot of chronic pain, then it salvages them. If I find a kid has wrist problem and it's their back, and I go, this is completely fixable. You can almost always get around that in a backhand. Forehand's a little bit tougher because you don't have another hand to fall on.
Right, right. Again, awesome stuff, Nir. Appreciate that. And obviously, we talked about the importance of cross training and how that could help us with reduce injuries and strengthen us. And I was just curious if I know you mentioned swimming, but I wonder. I wanted to ask you what maybe other sports that are best suited for cross training for tennis players that you'd like to suggest for us.
Well, you know, to be honest, junior players in your development pathway, I like sports like basketball and soccer that use your lower body, and there's agility involved and jumping, all these things that make you a better athlete, better tennis player. It is, you know, there is some certainly cross transfer of skills. As you grow into adult world and you get over 40, you're going to find less and less, you know, adult tennis players who are interested in doing that. So biking and yoga and Pilates and other things that just but offload some of these areas but still create some benefit are probably good choices as well.
Awesome, Nero. And also I just wanted to ask you, obviously, when you talked about lower back pain and and how that's like one of the top injuries. You had a lot of core exercises in there, and I just for the audience, for some who may wonder, you know, how that could help and why wouldn't we be just training like our back exclusively? If you could maybe explain why core exercises help us with our back issues.
Yeah, everyone will have, you know, a different way to explain it. And one way is, I think your body is like a cylinder. There's a front and back, right? And you want to keep the cylinder stable. And so if you have a front and back, you don't do just back muscles, but you work on the abdominal muscles and strengthen the whole cylinder and the front and back. Typically have people do the safest exercise, which are more neutral spine exercises. If I'm having them doing that on their own, a lot of those exercises we saw were bridging and planks and other things in neutral spine. So, but if you add a lot of bend or extension and rotation, then you might get, you know, you can work on those as well too. But then if you're doing unsupervised, to get a little worried, if especially a person isn't as knowledgeable about which planes are safe. So if you're neutral, sit on a Swiss ball and do a bridge or a plank, I'm a little less worried.
Great stuff, Nir. And one other question before I kind of ask you about all the wonderful things you're doing. I was just curious if you have any particular pieces of equipment that you'd like, that you'd suggest that we use that can help us a lot in our training and rehab, and B, if there's any books that you suggest we read as well.
So I, as far as equipment, you know, I get paid by no other manufacturers or anything like that, so I don't get any money from anyone, so no conflicts there. For those that with tennis elbow, actually, there's a thing called the TheraBand Flex Bar, which I recommend to countless number of patients, which is a simple rubber bar that you can use to strengthen your wrist and your elbow extensor and flexor muscles and tendons, which helps treat tennis elbow. It works very, very well. If you're able to get a low-weighted kind of a small hand-based medicine ball, you can do a lot of simple rehab with that. And any TheraBand, you know, just the straps you can get that can help strengthen your external rotators, and that you can do, you know, while you're on the road or, you know, before or after playing. So those are probably some of the simple ones. And as far as books, you know, Babette Plume and Mark Safran wrote a really good tennis medicine book. And, you know, it's in multiple languages. That helps quite a bit. And, you know, Mark Kovacs has an enormous library of different types of books as well, you know, through ITPA and complete conditioning and a number of things. I know that I've authored several chapters and some upcoming books that are coming out with Todd Allenbecker, who is the director of ATP Sports Medicine, and, you know, Ben Kibler. And so there's going to be more stuff coming out, I think, to help in the care of the tennis athlete.
Fantastic, Nehru. And obviously, you know, as you can see on the screen, you know, Nehru does a ton of fantastic, amazing, you know, work with several different facets of the tennis world. I did want to ask you about the Society for Tennis Medicine and Science, Nehru, and kind of, you know, what's that all about and what type of people may want to perhaps join or be involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, this is really an educational society. It was originally kind of formed to try to help produce scientific education and medical information and research for the tours, WTA and ATP, and then help with ITF. But it's really grown. I'm the current president, and, you know, this is our 27th year where we're trying to get, you know, just educate any healthcare provider on treating tennis players in a tennis-specific manner. We do have we have a number of coaches who are actually involved as well too, and they good friend Oliver Stevens, who I mentioned at the beginning, you know, has given us, you know, a number of talks and had been very active in it, because there are some that are very interested in keeping players healthy in addition to making better tennis players. So we invite anyone who's interested, you know, to get on tennismedicine.org and look out some of the, we have another journal and we run different meetings and get on. It's a very inexpensive organization because our mission is just education. So anything we do to help educate tennis players and the people who take care of them.
Wonderful, Nero. And also you mentioned the stroke efficiency rating that you're working with Dr. Mark Kovacs with and others. And I wanted you to ask, or I wanted to ask you about the stroke efficiency rating and also any other, you know, projects that you may be working on these days.
Yeah, well, stroke efficiency rating, as I mentioned, is really a tool, trying to create a tool that coaches could use. I think some sports science people are interested in it who are at the highest level, because it's pretty intricate and involved. And so the coaches are the one who we think will benefit for the most. So basically it simply is, it's a performance, potential performance measure or grade, as well as one for injury risk. And what we've done it in about 200 junior and elite players. We've published already once on it, and we have an upcoming publication based on our data. And basically let's say the scores, it's out of 102, let's call it 100. If your stroke efficiency rating is an 80, for example, then we think you have a high efficiency rating and you have a lower risk for injury and a high risk for performance. And we actually did find that it's actually best for, in fact, we use miles per hour on serves, and those that had the highest stroke efficiency ratings had the highest serves, serve miles per hour. And then also it worked by age. So as kids were getting older and improving their level, they went from junior player to, you know, high school and then college players, their stroke efficiency rating was increasing as well too. So I think it may be a developmental tool for coaches to look at and see. And then we'll have more information. I think Mark Kovacs and I are going to figure out a way to disseminate this information and maybe help teach coaches how to utilize it for those that are interested. And we'll have an injury checklist on there. So it'll be, you know, probably somewhere between 10 to 13 areas that we just make a checklist. Look at your player and say, do they have too much ulnar deviation? Do they have too much lumbar extension and on the serve and you know, things throughout the strokes that hopefully we can identify. An upcoming, or actually an ongoing thing, I should say, is actually this issue of assessing players prior to injury. And so we have a program with USDA Southern. And again, we usually get data and do research on this. And we're trying to, and we did this last year and it went very well, trying to get kids in who are junior tournament players and do a comprehensive musculoskeletal assessment, looking for injury risk areas, and then do an on-court assessment, looking at the stroke efficiency rating and kind of giving them feedback they can take back with their pro. And we, half of them are usually uninjured kids who are trying to prevent injury, and half of them are actually injured kids who've already, that I've already probably taken care of, or one of my colleagues. And now we're looking at them in a more comprehensive way to help return them to their sport. And so we're seeing if we can create this model that maybe other regions in the country can use, but we're kind of experimenting here with USDA Southern in Atlanta. So for anyone who's interested in bringing their kids out, we'll be starting that up pretty shortly again, you know, for the next 6 months of each year. And I guess I send you contact information that better. We can use, I think I use Tennis Medicine. I'll send you the site and the link for if anyone wants to contact us.
Wonderful stuff, Nero. Yeah, definitely happy to disseminate any of the information about those wonderful projects that are going to help so many people. I'm personally really excited to see how those pan out as well. And I guess I was going to ask you to, you know, the best place to maybe find or connect with you online or in person, or if you have any social media profiles or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll continue those well too, but I think I'm just at Neeru Jayanthi, N-E-E-R-U, Jayanthi, J-A-Y-A-N-T-H-I. You know, I have I think we have our Tennis Medicine site here. It's emoryhealthcare.org/tennismedicine. And then I should have that email better memorized, but it's our tennis, what is it? I think it's tennismedicine@emoryhealthcare.edu. And I'll confirm that with you for anyone who's interested in some of the projects that we're doing.
Wonderful, Nero. And so before I end this, I could talk to you for hours about this stuff because I'm so interested in it. But I just want to ask you, what is one key actionable tip that you can give our audience to have this so that they can improve their tennis fitness?
To improve their tennis fitness?
Well, health and fitness, I should say.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It sounds really simple and so basic, is actually spend 10 or so minutes before you get on the court and do a good dynamic warm-up that includes reproducing some of the activities that you would do during tennis and doing a slow gradual warm-up, including some lunges and some patterns and then going through those motions and shadow swings and everything before you get out there. I mean, I don't know how many times I see adults, the junior players are great, but the adults just get out there and they just start hitting it, or they do static stretches and they're the ones that are much more at risk than the junior players. So if you want some simple way to do it and do a service line warm-up when you get started and then work your way back. And I do that, and many, many, you know, higher level players, you know, do that, but it's still, I would say, amazing how I would probably estimate about 89% of players are not doing anything prior to playing when I see.
Well, Nero, I just want to thank you again for all the incredible work that you're doing as part of so many different organizations like STMS and Emory Medicine and ITPA and others. And I really appreciate you coming on the Tennis Summit 2018 to educate us about how we can reduce our injuries and come back strong from them. So thank you so much for joining us, and looking forward to connecting again soon and spreading the wonderful projects that you're doing to the audience.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on, and hopefully some of this word can get out there and help more players.
For sure. Thanks so much, Nero.